Welcome to another episode of Disrupt. I'm Home Healthcare News Senior Editor Andrew Downlin. Today's episode is with Joanne Cunningham, the CEO of the Partnership for Quality Home Healthcare, and David Totaro, the Chief Government Affairs Officer at Beata Home Healthcare. In this conversation, Cunningham and Totaro discuss all things related to the current payment landscape in home healthcare, including what to expect in terms of the proposed and final payment rules, what providers are doing and can do to fight back against cuts, and the chances of congressional intervention in the near-term future. Want to sponsor episodes of this podcast? Contact A. Donlin at WTWHmedia.com to learn more. A-D-O-N-L-A-N at WTWHmedia.com. Let's get into it. Okay, Dave and Joanne, thank you so much for joining me. I want to start broadly, and then we'll get into the specifics of this year and the advocacy efforts that you'll be working on. But what do you expect from the proposed payment rule, which usually drops in late June or early July? I guess let's take out anything that could happen as a result of advocacy. Right now, what are you expecting from that proposed rule?
Well, I anticipate that what we will see, given CMS's posture in prior rulemaking cycles, is we will see the continuation of the policy that will put in place permanent cuts to the Medicare home health program. We're bracing ourselves for an additional sizable permanent cut, and we don't know exactly what CMS has planned for the temporary cuts, otherwise known as the clawback cuts. But we will certainly see, at a minimum, CMS will identify what their new projected value of the temporary cuts are at the end of last year. It was in the final rule $3.4 billion in clawbacks that they were planning at some point. And we will see an updated temporary adjustment number. So that $3.4 billion is expected to go up.
So whether they, ultimately have a path forward on the clawbacks, they'll still include the number to show how large that has gotten.
Yes.
Okay. Dave, what about you? Anything to add there?
Well, I think Joanne summarized that very well. There hasn't been anything that I've seen over the last, say, 6 to 9 months that doesn't signal more of the same. CMS hasn't changed their rate setting model at all. So I think we're going to see additional cuts and clawbacks. That's why my team and I have been advocating on the Hill since the rule was released last year. We have still a lot of work yet to be done.
Okay, and taking a step back again before we move forward, what have cuts done to the home health care industry over the last couple of years? What has been compromised? What has changed for the worse? Dave, let's start with you this time.
Yeah, well, I think we can all agree that when you get cuts of this magnitude and you get red flags indicating that there are going to be future cuts, there's threats about clawbacks, but we don't know when those clawbacks are going to occur. It all sets up a planning scenario for your providers that's just fraught with uncertainty. And this impacts investment. Investment's important to home care. Investment in technology, investment in solving the workforce shortage situation through developing programs with recruitment and retention, and even expanding into regions where access to care has not yet been achieved. All of these supposedly are goals of CMS as well, but these cuts really act in an opposite direction. So I say, without a doubt, it's impacted our rural and hard-to-access urban regions. It's caused many agencies to begin to assess their ability to even sustain their business. And I've seen data just recently that suggests that more than half of the agencies providing care are considering whether they can actually continue to sustain their business or certainly must reduce services altogether.
And especially in the investment piece, Dave, it's at a time where home-based care is being valued more than ever, and the industry, you know, could be growing more than ever. So a critical time to be investing into new technologies, you know, new training programs, new ways of professionalizing the workforce, et cetera. So it's unfortunate that, you know, at a time like that, providers are having to pull back on things like that.
You're absolutely correct. We are a very big believer in investing in futures, specifically technology, and these cuts are going to have a significant impact on, in our future plans.
So, Joanne, Dave mentioned that him and his team have been on the Hill since the rule last year. I'm curious, you know, I cover this on a daily basis, but still not always sure what you all are doing on a day-to-day basis. I know it's always something, but I can never pinpoint when and where. So can you detail what the schedule in a given year looks like for home health advocacy? What happens before the proposed rule? What happens after, before the final rule, et cetera?
Sure. So essentially, I mean, what we're doing really throughout the entire calendar year is policy and advocacy. Policy, because we're always trying to think through policy responses, either through the legislative process or the regulatory process, that would present a way for the proposed rule, the payment model that we're living under, you know, ways for it to be improved. And then the other piece of that is advocacy. We are, since 2020, we have been working under this PDGM payment model, which going into this, I think the industry, the home health community writ large was excited about. You know, its promise was that this would be a more refined coding system and payment system that would better match a patient's condition to payment. Instead, since 2020, we have seen year after year of growing cuts that are accelerating, with essentially cuts going into at least 2028 and probably beyond. And that is a unstable environment, as Dave mentioned, that has real consequences for providers who are not only trying to invest in their organizations through quality programs and different public health initiatives to reach out to different populations, technology, workforce investment to ensure that staff training continues and that you're recruiting the best and brightest healthcare workforce. But we've had to deal with a mounting level of cuts. So part of what we constantly have to do is make sure that policymakers understand very vividly the impact of these. And the other thing that's worth really talking about and digging into is the fact that at a time when the general population is not just prefers care in the home, but is clamoring for more of it, we have a Medicare home health program that is dwindling, that is under such financial strain and pressure that its future is uncertain. I just don't know how that syncs up with what the public at large wants and needs. And, you know, demographics are pointing to more care in the home, not less.
Dave, on that note, can you detail some of the wins? You know, let's get a little positive here. Some of the wins you've seen at Beata over the years when it comes to advocacy, whether in Medicaid or Medicare, just as sort of a proof of concept when it comes to advocating as a provider or a leader or an advocate in the industry?
Sure, I could, but I would just like to add one thing to what Joanne was saying, and that is that you know, our schedule has always been go, go, go. There is no stop and go with advocacy. Consistency is what really matters. And one of the things that we've learned over the last, say, 6 to 9 months is that we our role as providers is to change the narrative from a discussion about cost and cuts to a narrative about why or how these cuts are going to impact the lives of our legislators' constituents. We've heard through many of our meetings that they are very interested in understanding how actions that they have taken or will be taken affect the lives of these folks. And so that's why we believe that you never stop. You continue to bring folks to your meetings that are going to be able to humanize this issue rather than have it based on data. So let me address your other question, which is about the wins. We've been very successful in leading one of the industry's, or I should say I've been very happy to lead one of the industry's strongest advocacy teams, Hearts for Home Care, which is a separate but affiliated social welfare organization about home health care. And we were formed dedicated to solely support advocacy efforts. And we did this because we believe strongly that it does work. Advocacy works. I know it's hard for many today to believe that it's worth the time and effort to actually sit down with your legislator, because we've seen what goes on in D.C. or in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, or almost in any state capital. You know, sometimes I've said this to many, I've questioned whether a bill that would designate the second Sunday in May as a day to honor all mothers would actually get passed today in the U.S. Congress. But, you know, consistency does work. My team, for example, last year alone participated in 17 different advocacy efforts around Medicaid in the markets that we support. And through our efforts, we realized more than $325 million in home and community-based investments by state legislatures. We also just recently completed a study where we showed that consistent advocacy initiatives compared the results to those states where we have not had consistency in our efforts. And we discovered that since 2015, in the states where we've had a consistent advocacy effort year after year, our Medicaid rates have actually increased on average by 23%. And in those states where we have not had a consistent effort for a number of different reasons, our Medicaid rates have actually been cut on average by about 7%. So, you know, I could go on and on about the success we've had at state and federal levels, but just let me say that the last thing, that Congress actually saw home health as a solution, home health care as a solution rather than a cost during the COVID crisis. And that's because I believe that we all came together as one industry with one strong, loud voice.
Yeah, and Dave, to your first point, I thought it was very powerful in the congressional hearing, I believe it was last year, when the Mary Lanning healthcare representative talked about, also from the provider perspective, I think it was Hastings, Nebraska, they had covered 60-mile radius and it was down to 25 already. And that was, you know, last summer. So who knows how much the coverage area has shrank at this point. Joanne, do you have anything to add there on policy wins over the years? And, you know, maybe another point on that consistency aspect?
Sure. I would say that the mitigation of any of the cuts that we've seen on the table would not happen without fierce and sustained and aggressive advocacy. We have been successful over the years, every payment cycle, to push back a deeper payment reduction than what CMS had proposed. And we've done that every single year. It doesn't happen without the entire home health community, including the partnership and NAC and all of the members, organizations like Beata, which are a top tier advocacy organization that has the structure and kind of the ground troops to lend to this effort. But it doesn't happen by accident. It happens because we do the hard work and we do it We do it very aggressively and very strategically. We arm ourselves with data about the quality that home health provides, about the cost savings that home health delivers to the taxpayer, which is significant. And we do it demonstrating and showing that there's also ample data that home health, home care, care in the home, all of that is strongly and widely supported by the public, and especially older Americans.
Joanne, when we talk about grassroots advocacy, what do we really mean by that? What do providers need to do in order to be a part of those efforts?
It's really simple. They can go to our website or NAHC's website and get engaged with a click of a button. But what we mean is that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of home health advocates around the country, including many of those who work for home health organizations and home care organizations. You know, if you ever did a visit with an agency like Bayada, you're going to meet an awful lot of people who have a lot of choices in the healthcare sector regarding where, you know, a place to work. And they choose to work for an organization that delivers care in the home. And one of the reasons is that they've experienced it firsthand. They've seen the benefit and how valuable it is to the people who receive care in the home. And they've never looked back. They've never left the sector. So we do have a passionate workforce. And I'm glad you mentioned the congressional hearing. You heard firsthand from a leader, a couple of leaders at agencies, who spoke very passionately about the fact that, you know, they've been doing home health, home care work for decades themselves, and they know the impact that it has, not just on the patient who wants to be at home to receive their recovery care and rehab care, but also the family members who want to have their family member at home receiving care in the home. So we do have a passionate workforce. We also have what I call grass tops, and that is the senior leaders of home health organizations who tend to have very, very strong relationships with policymakers in their communities. Some of those individuals are folks like Dave Totaro, as well as other senior leaders at Bayada and at every home care organization in the country. And we really rely on them to lend you know, their kind of personal take, their personal commitment to deliver that message to, you know, senior policymakers, either on Capitol Hill or in state capitals all across the country.
Dave, anything to add there?
Yes, I do. You know, I'm proud that I'm seeing our grassroots efforts increase month to month by the entire industry. Yesterday, I was in Raleigh, North Carolina, where we had our largest advocacy day ever. We had over 50 home health, home care, and hospice providers from all across the state join us in Raleigh for our annual advocacy lobby day. And over 40% of the more than 250 who attended were attending for the very first time.
Wow.
You know, 15 years ago, when I formed our first advocacy team at Bayada, we were among the very few who had invested in this function. But today, it has become almost an essential staple of anyone who wants to survive in this industry. At Bayada, you know, we have invested a great deal in building our grassroots program. We have more than 350 volunteer employees who are now today trained and updated quarterly on all our issues so that they can at any time immediately join us, walk the halls of Congress or at the state capitals whenever we need them. And I mentioned Hearts for Home Care, which was formed just a year ago. We today have over 4,000 registered members of Hearts for Home Care. These are advocates from all across the United States. So we're putting a lot of time and effort into this because we know that it works. The last point I want to make on this is that yesterday I had a North Carolina state senator who actually approached me and told me that he glazes over anytime folks come in and talk too much data to him because he doesn't remember most of it the next day. But if I would bring in someone who can humanize, personalize the issue, such as a caregiver or a patient, then he will remember that story forever. And that's what we tell our advocates to do every day.
That's really interesting, too. And I also think, you know, PQHH, NOC, and others have done a good job of simplifying the data. You know, if you have that human approach, that person-centered approach, but then with some simple chartable data in the background, I think that's helpful, you know, rather than a 25-page pamphlet on clawbacks and cuts and PDGM specifics. Okay, Joanne, what's the single most important thing providers can do? I know you mentioned going to the website, getting involved, but if they could just do one thing today, what would that be?
So the one thing is whatever you have already done, whether it's a phone call, an email, a visit, do it again, because repetition matters in advocacy. It's going to take more than a single person making a single phone call or a single email. It has to be done over and over and over again in order to have the punch that it needs. We are, home health, home care is competing with not just every other sector of healthcare who also is expressing their desire to see policy and legislative change, but we're competing against all kinds of other interests, you know, transportation, the environment, taxes, housing. So we've got to make sure that we keep our message front and center with lawmakers and policymakers more than just once. It's got to be repeated and sustained and consistent over a period of time. Otherwise, our voices get drowned out by others. And, you know, volume matters and the number of voices matters. And that's the reason why we've got to dial up anything that we've done before. We've got to dial it up, you know, another 50%. And if every advocate did that, then, you know, we would see some significant, massive change and increase and uptick in our advocacy.
Dave, anything to add there before we move on?
Yes, I do. I agree with Joanne. Consistency really matters because, you know, that's how you build a brand. And what we're doing is we're building the brand as we advocate. But I also would suggest something very simple. Build a relationship with your legislator, whether that's a state legislator or a federal legislator. I am so shocked when I see these surveys that show that a huge percentage of Americans don't have a clue about who's representing them in Congress or in their state capital. So my first suggestion is find out who they are, reach out and talk to them. They want to hear from you. You don't have to even go to Washington to meet with them. In fact, if you meet with them in their district offices, they have a lot more time to spend with you. And then second, as I've repeated before, I would also suggest you bring a patient or a caregiver along with you. Let them do the talking. Have them frame what the challenges are that they face. Legislators today do realize that home care saves money, but we need to make them aware that we can only save them money if they will invest in home care so that we can actually treat and take care of patients.
What is the ultimate goal for advocacy this year? Obviously, you know, the elephant in the room is what we've been talking about the whole time. It's the cuts. But what realistically can be achieved by advocacy this year in order to put home health providers in a better spot by year end? Dave, let's start with you and then we'll go to Joanne.
Well, I think our ultimate goal this year is to stop those cuts, whether they're current, future clawbacks. We have a bill in Congress that's been championed and sponsored by, you know, Senator Stabenow and Collins, both very respected long-time advocates for home health care and Representative Sewell and Smith that we're advocating for, and it's our goal to get that legislation passed this year. It's a surprise to us, as Joanne has mentioned, that, you know, as boomers are reaching the age for care that, and most of them want to be treated for at home, that we're facing cuts of this magnitude. It's just unconscionable.
Joanne, anything to add there?
Dave hit the nail on the head. We need to pass legislation. It will be a version of the Stabenow, Collinsville, Sewell, and Smith on the House side. We are working on revisions right now with Senator Stabenow, and we are going to ensure that we have all of the things we need in place so that we are ready for any kind of opportunity that presents itself as far as a package. But we need to get that done. It is imperative in order to ensure the future home health program. It's absolutely a must do.
Yeah, this interviewer didn't do a great job of setting up that question. In a conversation around home health cuts, what do we want to stop? Home health cuts, that makes sense. But Joanne, I am curious, you and I had a conversation maybe last month, and you said that I thought it might be more noisy in Washington, D.C. because of the election this year. You said that it's actually a good thing that's an election year because legislators are more in touch with their constituents.
Yeah, I mean, I think that anytime it's an election year, you know, Congress is acutely aware of the fact that they're all up for re-election, you know, a third of the Senate and all of the House, and it is a presidential year. So we will use that to our advantage, and we will make sure that the squeaky wheel of home health gets the grease this year and make sure that we are, you know, putting in place a policy that can be supported and ensure that we have removed any obstacles in our way. But we do look at an election year as an opportunity.
Okay. Final thoughts, Dave, anything to add on what you want to achieve this year, a call to action to providers, or anything else?
Well, I can say that I am optimistic, and sometimes it's questionable why I am, but I'm optimistic that our movement has grown significantly over the year. As I said, I attended a lobby day yesterday where we've actually doubled in size in 1 year, and most of the growth was new folks who've come for the first time. I'm optimistic because during the pandemic, the role that we played as an industry in supporting and even standing up the whole healthcare system during the crisis was actually a silver lining for the industry, and I think it's known. So it's our role now is to make decision makers look past those what they're looking at today, look past today into the future, and see that what our role can be and what health care delivery can look like for everyone if they can just make the right decisions and support home health care.
Joanne, final thoughts.
I'm optimistic too. I share Dave's optimism. I don't know that you can work in the home health and home care field without feeling optimistic because you know, we believe in the model of care. We believe deeply that care in the home is a critically important program and needs to be enhanced and improved and expanded upon and not cut. And we see policymakers respond to that. And so I am optimistic because I do think our message is one that resonates. We just have to make sure that we line up all of the things that we need to do to be ready to be included in a, you know, end of year or package that appears at an optimal point during the rest of the congressional session. We've got great advocates in our bill sponsors led by Senator Stabenow and Collins. And so I'm very optimistic about success and getting this job done.
All right, Dave and Joanne, thank you so much for joining the Disrupt podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Disrupt. For more news and insights on the home health, home care, and hospice industries, subscribe to our daily or weekly newsletters at homehealthcarenews.com or consider becoming an HHCM Plus member. I'm Andrew Donlin, and this has been a production of WTWH Media.